Okay. As I said, I'm going to jump right in. We're going to read two stories. And again, I made a lot more text than we're actually going to be reading inside, but I brought them for you to please follow along as I discuss things outside. I think in the interest of time, just for today, we'll sort of skip over some of the sources, but I will always refer to what I'm reading, so feel free to follow along. Okay, first source on your booklet. Vayidi Amin Hahein, Melech Ein B'Yisrael. It was in those days, in the days of Shoftim we're speaking about, just to give you a sense chronologically, we're talking approximately 1200 BCE to about 1050, 1025. Okay, we are going to encounter now the story of a pilegesh, okay, of a concubine. Now, it's not 100% clear from the text why this woman had the status of concubine and not full-fledged wife. I think the reasons really aren't important. I think the fact that this man refused to bestow upon his wife the status of full-fledged wife is what we're going to really be focusing on. And for whatever reason, for reasons we're not told, but we could imagine, we could fill in the blanks really using our imagination, Pasuk Bet, Vatizne Alav Pilag Sho, Vatelech Meito El Beit Aviha. For whatever reason, this woman was unfaithful to her husband. Now, I think that we have to understand that in Tanakh, the Shorash Zanah does not always imply she had an extramarital affair. Unfaithful, I think, in the context of the story, in particular because her husband followed after her and tried to bring her back to his home, implies just unfaithfulness, perhaps the very fact that she ran to her father's house, ran away from her husband's house, back to her father's house, was in and of itself, in the mind of the Tanakh, unfaithful, and we're going to get back to that point. And then I'm going to summarize parts of the story. She basically goes to her father's home. She's there for approximately 4 months. After a while, the husband follows her to the father's home to bring her back to his house. And there's sort of a power struggle going on. The father says, oh, no, no, stay here. And the husband says, oh, no, no, we have to go. And that goes on for a couple of days until finally the husband wins out. He takes the pilegesh, puts her on a donkey with him. And I'm going to, we're going to look. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Okay? He takes her on the donkey. It's this man, his na'ar, his helper, his young man helper, and this pilegesh. They go and they're riding back to the husband's home. And if you look in Pasuk Yud Aleph, first in Pasuk Yud, they come, they get close to Yerushalayim, and that day Yerushalayim was still in the hands of the Yebusim. And he doesn't want to stay there, this man, because he says, no, 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 it's not safe. We're not going to be amongst our people. And the irony, obviously, of that comment will become apparent in a couple of moments. He says, I don't want to stay in Yerushalayim with the Yebusim. Let's travel on to Giv'ah, to the place of the Binyamin, the Nakhala, the territory where the Shevet of Binyamin live. Let us go there instead. And so they go all the way to Binyamin. And if you read through inside the Psukim, no one takes them in. No one invites them into their home. They're sort of stuck in the courtyard, if you imagine, in the center square, in the center of town. No one's inviting them in. Until finally a nice old man, who happens not to be from Shevet Binyamin, comes along and invites them to his house. And if you look in Psukim, Yud Tet, really, through Chaf Aleph, what you see are these gentlemen exchanging niceties, and the man, the Levite, says, oh, let me pay you for our stay. And the old man says, no, 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 I can't accept your payment. And there's this beautiful exchange going on between these lovely, honorable gentlemen. Okay? We read a little further. Pasuk Chaf Bet. Hema Meitivim Et Libam. They basically, you have the people of the town banging at the door. It's unclear what perhaps modes of hospitality this man crossed. We're not really sure. Somehow he angered the people of his town. They're banging at his door saying, send out your guests so we can rape him. Okay, and if this is reminding anyone of the accounts in Sodom, that's not accidental. The author was very deliberately evoking that image for us. And so the man leaves and he says, "Bal habayit hazakein lemor." Excuse me, sorry. "Vayitzei ha'ish bal habayit vayomer aleihem alachai al tareyuna." Right? Don't do this type of thing. He calls it a nevela. Don't commit this outrageous crime. Rather, what? Pasuk chavdalit. No. Don't do that to my guest. Let me throw out to you my virgin daughter and this man's concubine instead, and let's call it a day. Okay, at first the men outside don't agree, but if you look, unfortunately, in Pasuk Kav Hey, V'lo avu ha'anashim lishmo alo, they didn't listen. V'yachazek ha'ish tefilah, so he grabbed his concubine. V'yotzei alehem ha'chutz, and he shoved her outside to this violent crowd waiting. V'yitz'uotza v'yitz'aluluba kol ha'layla ad ha'boker. And they raped and tortured her, really, until the morning. V'tavoha isha lifnot ha'boker v'tipol petach ha'bayit v'yit ha'ish asher udena sham ad ha'or. Okay, this woman stumbles home at the break of dawn, gets to the house, gets to the doorpost, and she basically has her hand on the doorknob and collapses. Now, the Mefarshim, actually, Rashi included on this pasuk, are so troubled by the fact that the Tanakh never mentions that she died, that they say at this point she died. I think, if anything, it's very, very poignant. The Tanakh never actually mentions when she died, as if that was almost inconsequential, really, in the turn of events. Pasuk Chafayim, Vayakam Adonai HaBavoker. Okay, he wakes up in the morning, fresh and rejuvenated from a good night's sleep, which in and of itself should be horrifying. Vayiftach daltot habayit vayitzei lalechet lidarko. V'hine ha'isha filag sho nofelet petach habayit v'yadeha al hasaf. He walks out, he sees her laying there on the floor. Vayomer eleha kumi v'neilecha. And he basically says, get up, let's go. She doesn't answer. Ve'ein oneh v'yikachseha al hachamor. And remember the image of a donkey. He slings her over the back of a donkey. And they go back to their place. He takes the knife that is specifically used, if you recall, Avram used that knife by the Akedah, it's a knife that's specifically used for korbanot. He basically dismembered her into 12 pieces and sent her out to the different tribes in the country. Okay, and by your faces, I apologize. It's not the story you get up for on a Sunday morning. I should have known from the title it wasn't going to be pretty, but. Okay, story number one. Story number two. Parakeet Aleph, and I'm going to summarize a little more. I'm just nervous about the time now that we started late. Story number two, we have a man named Yiftach. Parakeet Aleph in Sefer Shoftim. Now, Yiftach is not a bad guy. Yiftach, as the Shoftim go, and by the way, I'm always going to tell you, anytime you mention a Shoftim's name, to refer to your timeline. Just to get a sense of things. He was not a bad guy. For the most part, we're told that he had a relative fear of God. We don't see him intermarrying the way we see some of the other Shoftim doing. He was actually a very effective negotiator. At one point, his people were sort of engaged in a disagreement with the Ammonim, and he gets them out of that agreement. He was an effective mediator, negotiator, which we'll see is, once again, ironic. And he's out at war, and not uncommon for men in wartime. He's perhaps nervous about the outcome, and so he says to God, God, if you make me successful on the battlefield, I swear that the very first thing that comes running out of my home, I will sacrifice to you as in Olah, as one of the korbanot that has to be completely burnt and sacrificed to God. Now, just to give you a sense, we actually have from excavations from Iron Age 1, which is really the time of the Shoftim, the houses were actually shaped in almost a U shape, with the courtyard in the middle, and the animals and the people really did live in that house. And so it's not crazy to think that the animal, that he was imagining, an animal running out when in fact his daughter ran out instead. I don't think we have to read more into his intentions than we need to, than what the pshat says. But what happens on his return home? Pesach Lamed Dalid, Vayavo Yiftach HaMitzpah, now he won, he was victorious. He's coming home, El Beito, Hinei Beito Yotzeit, Likrato bitzupim v'imcholot. We see this throughout Tanakh. Women are often running out to greet the venerated heroes. She runs out with timbrels and she's singing and dancing for him. V'rakhi yichida ein lo mimenu ben obat. Again, if the language reminds you of, right, kach et bincha et yichincha asher ahavta et yitzchak, the tension building as we're reminded that this is his only daughter. Once again, that's not accidental. Unfortunately, the outcome of this story is going to be greatly different. And I will summarize the end. He says to her, oh my goodness, look what you've done. She essentially says to him, well, if you made that vow, then you have to stick to it. And he allows her 2 months to go up to lament with her friends as to her status and what's going to happen to her. She does so, and if you look at the pshat, again, keeping the interpretations in the Farshim out of it, if you look carefully, it says, pasuk, Pasuk Lamed Zayin, Hatomer Elavia, Yeaseli Hadavar Hazeh. She basically says, do it, and ultimately he does what he promised in war, which means that he killed his daughter. Okay. I think that, and by the way, in the last century and a half or so, there's been a proliferation of feminist criticism of Tanakh. It's a scholarly field that's really, I think, continually growing. And it's probably not surprising that these stories and some of the other stories that we encounter in Sefer Shoftim is really a starting point for many of the conversations, many of the questions that are asked. Some seminal works have really revolved around these stories. I think for us, as people who look to Tanakh as our guide, as our moral compass, as really defining for us how to behave, what is appropriate and what is not, I think what's disturbing when we read these stories, perhaps even more than the content itself, although the content itself is obviously disturbing, I think the silence of the Tanakh, I think the silence of the story following these events, the fact that no Navi comes in and says, whoa, 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 just to let you know, this isn't okay. No voice of God, no Ruach Elohim comes and says, this is absolutely unacceptable behavior. Women are not expendable. Women can't be treated like that. I think for us, just reading the stories on its surface is somewhat disturbing. Very, very disturbing. And so what I wanted to talk about today really is something very important, and I'm going to speak about it in the context of women, specifically women as they appear in Sefer Shoftim. But I think it's really something that applies to any story we encounter in Tanakh. And that is the being able to really separate between the two layers of any narrative that we encounter. What do I mean by that? Sefer Shoftim, okay, as with most stories in Tanakh, were created in a patriarchal society. And so all the implications of men dominating any public realm, political, religious, military realm, the men were for the most part in charge. Now, I think that this is sort of something difficult that we sometimes have to wrestle with, but we have to always remember that while the books of Tanakh are authoritative, and while we turn to them for guidance, because they were written b'nivua and because they were incorporated into Tanakh, okay, at the same time, what we have to remember is that they were also written by human beings who were products of a society that was vastly, vastly different than ours. Okay? And we can't expect certain models of behavior we can't really sort of superimpose our perceptions of what's normal, of what's okay in terms of society, on a totally, completely different world. Okay? At the same time, okay, we also can't read in to context, okay, what the author does or does not say, meaning we cannot assume that just because an author and the works that he or she produces in a certain historical context, okay, means that he or she condones those values underlying that social norm. Okay? And there's really, really a very, very important difference between them. And I'll give you an example because I think perhaps it'll be easier for us to relate to. If you were to open up a random book, okay, that was written in the South in the 1700s, okay, about slavery, okay, you wouldn't automatically assume that just because it's the setting or the background of the story is slavery, that therefore automatically the author assumes that black people are inferior, they're less inherently valuable, and so therefore they must be subjugated to a different role. Okay? If you read carefully, even if, let's say theoretically, you open up to chapter 7, okay, and in chapter 7, randomly you see terrible, really detailed abuses of the slave by the slave master, still you can't necessarily make any assumptions about the orientation of the author until you read the entire book. Because when you read the entire book as a whole, okay, what you might realize is that, in fact, really, the author wrote a story about a brilliant, competent, benevolent, any number of adjectives you want to stick in there, slave who was able to outwit his master, who was able to really succeed and contribute positively to the people around him. Okay, and so really, if you read the entire book carefully, what you find is that the purpose of the book, okay, is to really undermine those values upon which the institution of slavery is founded. Okay? That being said, I want to go back to Sefer Shoftim. And again, I said this is really just an example of how we have to read Tanakh. I brought Sefer Shoftim as an example for two really important reasons. I think first and foremost, we have more than probably any other Sefer in Tanakh, an abundance of stories about women, and not just women in the background, but women really playing very prominent roles in how the story turns out. That's a very, very compelling explanation for this, that two separate scholars wrote articles that appeared almost at the same time, And they explain that at points in history, traditionally, where the political realm was somewhat closer, or where the gap, I should say, between the political realm and the domestic realm was really much more narrow. So in times, for example, in pre-monarchic times, before there was a king in Israel, and there wasn't yet a centralized authority, okay, the domestic and the political realms were really very, very close. They were very closely linked. We're talking here about a decentralized, non-hierarchical society. And so many of the decisions that were made that had political ramifications were made within a more narrow jurisdiction, if you want to call it, within the sort of the perimeter of a family, clan, tribe. Okay, and so they sort of explain for that reason that women were really much more involved in the things that were going on in Sefer Shoftim. It also explains, by the way, a lot of what takes place in Megillat Rut, which we know also took place during the period of Shoftim, where women are very involved in the issue of lands and what's going to happen, and they don't bring it to the central authority in the urban center, but they take it to the Sha'ar, where the Zakenim, where the people of that clan or that tribe would sit and decide legal proceedings. Okay, that being said, that's the first reason, I think, because of the preeminence of female story. The second reason I picked Sefer Shoftim is because, like I said, just as if we were reading a book about slavery and we wanted to sort of understand the point of what the author was saying, I think perhaps Sefer Shoftim, more than any other Sefer, the, if you want to call it, polemical arguments of the author is relatively clear. We see the refrain over and over by Amim Ahim, Inav Yisrael, Isha Yashar Be'inav Yasdem. One of the things that the author of Sefer Shoftim really wanted us to come away understanding is that a society without a king falls to pieces. And that if there is no centralized authority, and if there is no ruling, if you want to call it class or person, over people, then the society totally and absolutely disintegrates, almost to the point of no return. Okay? Now, one of the ways in which the author does that is that he organizes the book very carefully. And what we're going to see, and again, I'm going to constantly be referring you to your charts, what we're going to see is that there's a very deliberate, degenerative process that takes place over the course of the Shoftim. The stories that we see, if we read them each in a vacuum, some are good, some are bad, some are nice, some aren't, okay? But it really goes beyond that. What we're going to see is an absolute and a very, I think, clear deterioration from Perek Aleph through the end of the Sefer. Now, the way in which the author does this, again, is A, through the stories themselves, but just to make sure that we as the readers don't lose sight of this degenerative process, just to ensure that when we get to the end of the Perek, we say, wow, how have they gotten from point A to point Z? What the author does is he uses markers or literary motifs along the way to clue us in, to compel the reader to read each story in light of that which comes before it. Okay? And so I'm going to give you a couple of examples. And again, I think that we're just going to skip over some of them. If we start, and again, Sefer Shoftim is really founded on the notion that Am Yisrael did not do their job fully. They came into Eretz Yisrael in the days of Yoshua. Their job, as was made clear by God, was to conquer the entire land, to get rid of all the Shivam Canaan that was already living there, and to then live peacefully. And one of the things that the Sefer is really founded on is the notion that they did not do that fully, that they didn't complete the conquest, and so they were continually having trouble with their neighbors. And that's really what you have in Prakim Aleph and Prakim Bet, if you look at source number 3 on your sheet. But at the beginning of the Sefer, what we encounter are what you might call either paradigms or sort of the prototypes, the ideal judges, okay, that the Sefer speaks about. We're coming on the heels of Yoshua and that entire generation, okay, the people that were worthy enough to enter Eretz Yisrael after all of their ancestors had died in 40 years in the Midbar, right? And we see, for example, I'm going to use the example of Atniel ben Kenaz in source number 4. Okay, we see that there are certain details recorded about Atniel. Now, by the way, the details about him are sparse, but I think really any time we have sparse details about a person, it makes them that much more effective as a prototype. Okay, because what we're going to notice about him in source 4 is just a number of things. We see in Pasuk Chet that God got angry at the people because they weren't behaving properly. And so we see that God appointed Atniel ben Kenaz to be his emissary. He functioned first as a judge. Okay, he led the people out to war, and he was clear in his mind, and he made sure that the people understood that the war that he was fighting was on behalf of God. It was an extension of Kibush Ha'aretz, okay, and everything was very clearly defined for him and for the people. Similarly, if we look down at the next Shofet at Ehud, okay, we see a similar concept, and I'm mentioning him more because he's going to come up again a little bit later. We see Ehud ben Gera again. a man who recognizes that he's fighting this war on behalf of God, on behalf of the people. And he was, everyone probably remembers the story, he was a lefty, right? And so he outmaneuvered the slovenly King Eglon, who had been persecuting the Jews for so many years. He stabbed him, right? He locked him in the bathroom, jumped off the terrace. It makes for a great story. And again, he was a successful leader at the very beginning of the Sefer, seen in a positive light by the author for all that he was able to accomplish. Okay? If we look a little bit further, if you turn the page, source number 5, we already see on some level things going down. And again, some issues are more subtle than others. For example, we encounter another shofet named Gidon, okay? Source number 5, okay? We see that just prior to Gidon, Hashem had sent a Navi to the people. This is one of the really the only Navi'im other than Zvorah that appears in the Sefer. He sent a Navi to the people to state very explicitly, the reason you're having all these troubles is because you didn't finish conquering your enemies and you're not behaving properly. And I told you this was going to happen. Okay? If you look down a little bit further, in Pasuk Yudbet, Gidon is standing there and near his home. So Malach appears to Gidon. He says to him, you are a man of valor. You are going to go out to war and be successful. And Gidon immediately turns to this Malach and he says, why have all these horrible things befallen us? Why are we suffering, really angry at God, questioning and really hurling, angry questions at God? And already we see that the Shofet himself was unable to internalize the message that the Navi just two psukim earlier had come to tell the nation. Okay, and so again, the status of the Shoftim themselves is already in decline. Not only is he not able to internalize the message of the Navi, which the Navi was really pretty explicit, okay, but we see a couple of psukim later, he asks for a sign. He's ambivalent to go out to war, and he makes God promise him, and he makes this Malach sort of give him one sign after the next. The night before battle, he does it again. And this fear, this lack of faith, okay, in his mission. Now, just to be clear, he wasn't a horrible guy. Gidon actually turned out to be a relatively good leader. We don't go from good to horrible immediately. It's a slow progression. He was a relatively good leader, and if you look, for example, okay, in Pasuk Chafet, after he had successfully won a number of wars, says Vayomru Ish Yisrael El Gidon Mishal Banu Gam Ata Gam Bincha Gam Ben Benim Benacha Ki Oshatam Miyad Binyan. The people come and ask him to be king, okay, and sort of echoing, if you want to say, really predating the words of Shmuel Hanavi, he says, Vayomar Alehem Gidon Lo Emshol Ani Bachem Velo Yemshol Bini Bachem Hashem Yemshol Bachem. Okay, so he's not an utterly terrible guy. He's someone who, by the end, once he is victorious, once he was able to see the hand of God clearly, was able to say, God is meant to be your ruler. You're not ready yet for a king. Okay, now, in contradistinction to his son, who comes next, I'm no psychologist, but I can pretty confidently say his son was a sociopath. Okay, his son Avimelech gets up. He says, I want to be king. Make me ruler over you. And essentially killed anyone who got in his path. Okay, and again, following Avimelech, we have, if you look, for example, Shimshon. Okay, source number 6. One of the cardinal sins we know, well, not cardinal meaning one of the three, but one of the major, major sins that it is throughout Tanakh not okay to do is intermarry. Okay, and Sefer Shoftim makes it explicitly clear, source 6, Perek Gimel, that intermarriage is the root of most of the degenerative behavior that went on during this period. It was because Am Yisrael was intermarrying with the daughters of the people that they had left in the land and not fully conquered. Okay, that being said, it's somewhat striking when we get to Parak Yudalit and we see Shimshon, who was a shofet, who was supposed to function as the leader of the people. He was chosen before his birth, right, to be this Nazir Elokim. We see him going back to his parents and saying, I found this really pretty plishti girl and I want you to bring her to me to marry. Okay, and she's not the only plishti woman that he's involved with in his lifetime. Okay, and so we see in terms of their relationship with God, in terms of their in terms of their religious behavior, in terms of intermarriage, we see all of that really going on this downward spiral as the course of the Sefer continues. Source number 7, okay, it probably shouldn't surprise us. And by the way, I'll go back to Shimshon for 1 second. One of the things that really falls by the wayside, you'll notice if you go back to the sources of Atniel, and I apologize again, I'm rushing. If you go back to the sources with Atniel, we see that in the early Shoftim, what we see is that after they vanquished the enemy, the Navi makes sure to tell us, and the people enjoyed X number of years of calm. right? If it's 80 years, if it's 20 years, whatever it is, it seems that on some level the Shofet was able to deal with the imminent danger, with the imminent threat, and while it didn't completely get rid of the problem, it did save them for the time being, for a generation or so. Once we hit people like Shimshon, not only are we not told of a relative calm, we're really not told of anything, any problems that he solves. If you look carefully at the life of Shimshon, okay, he's basically instigating the Plishtim once again and again and again. There's actually a point in his life where his own people come to him and say, Shimshon, enough. Turn yourselves over because we're being killed because of you and your personal vendettas. Many of the wars that Shimshon was actually fighting were over the women that he loved. His potential father-in-law married his potential wife off to someone else, and so he went and killed a couple of hundred Plishtim. Okay, and those personal vendettas instigated attacks on Am Yisrael. And so rather than saving the people, we see that as the Sefer went on, for example, with Avimelech, who killed his own, and Shimshon, we see things really getting worse and worse, and not even close to fitting into the prototype of people like Othniel and Ehud. Okay, one of the things, and I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, but one of the things that I mentioned is that we see markers, okay? Just in case we weren't going to be tuned into this deterioration within the Sefer, I apologize, I didn't mean to turn. Everyone followed my cue. Don't turn yet. Go back to source 7 for a second. One of the things that we're going to see are motifs or markers, okay, that clue us in, okay? Source number 7, for example, okay, we see that, again, at the beginning of the Sefer, we hear of money being acquired through the wars and Am Yisrael being able to take that. Source number 7, we see that the deterioration amongst the Shoftim really, as we would imagine, dissipates, and we see that Am Yisrael is really reacting in kind. So, for example, in Perek Yitzayim, we're already towards the end of the Sefer, we see this guy Micha. This is immediately following the story of Shimshon, where we imagine the place really to be in shambles. We see this guy Micha, who initially, I'm going to summarize the story, steals money from his mother. His mother makes a vow, anyone who stole my money should die. So he says, oh, it was me. He turns it over. She says, I'm so proud of you for telling the truth. Come, let's build an egel and a masecha. Let us build cultic objects to worship foreign gods. Okay, a beautiful story. What's fascinating is that Micha actually convinces a lady, right, a holy lady, to come work in his, what he calls his little temple, right, his shrine or whatever you want to call it. The lady agrees, until a couple of people walking by say, come with us, we'll pay you some more. The lady is bought off, runs away, and on their way out, what do? They steal poor Micha's idol, and so they run away with his idol. Micha runs after them, now you could officially turn your pages, and we see that he runs after them, and he's saying, okay, he's saying, no, you stole my idol, and they say in Pasuk Chav Hei, Vayomru Elav B'Neidan, Al Tashma Polcha Imani, Hen Yifke'u Bachem, Okay, I think here we see a very important manifestation. The Sefer keeps speaking of this ra that the Bnei Yisrael were doing, this evil that the Bnei Yisrael were involved in. And I think that in the story of Micha, we see the ra manifesting really in both its forms. We see the ra as the evil, meaning the dysfunction in their relationship with God, and we also see how it manifests amongst themselves. The people of Dan are saying, Micha, go home and stay quiet because we can't control our men. And if you bother them, they just might kill you and your entire family, and we just can't help it because, you know, they're hooligans. Okay? That's essentially what happens. And so we see this evil being spoken about manifesting both in their relationship with God, in their interpersonal relations with each other. Okay? In terms of the motifs and the markers that I was speaking about, if we look, for example, in source number 8, We see that in the beginning of the Perek, in the beginning of the Sefer, Bnei Yisrael are suffering. Again, as I mentioned, at the hands of their enemies. And a Malach Hashem appears to them and he says, you're suffering. Again, this sort of refrain that it's almost difficult for us to understand how the people didn't internalize this message. Malach Elokim comes and says, you're suffering because you didn't do what you're supposed to do. And the entire nation starts weeping. Okay, and there's really sincere remorse. And we see in Pasuk Hey, for example, source number 8, they cried, they did what seems to be really sincere tshuva. Okay? A little later on, at the very end of the Sefer, okay, once again we see this motif of crying, of the entire nation gathering together and weeping. How has such a thing happened? Okay? But by the time they're weeping in Parakhaf, okay? They're not weeping because there's an external enemy trying to fight them. They're not weeping because they're not able to finish Kibush HaAretz. Okay? They're weeping because by that point they were embroiled in a civil war, between the Shvatim and Shevet Ben Yamin. And by the time they're crying, if you look in Parakhah, Vayivku Vayishusham, Vayishusham, right, they were crying that they had almost wiped out an entire tribe of their people. Okay, and so again, when we come across this crying in Parakhah, we're automatically judging this crying against the crying we saw in the beginning of the Sefer. Some perhaps less, I would say, less obvious ones. If you look, for example, we mentioned Ehud ben Gera at the very beginning of the Sefer as a lefty, right? And that left-handedness was what enabled him to kill the enemy of Am Yisrael, and everyone was celebrating his success. That's in Source 9, Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Okay? If you look once again in Perek Chaf, all of those things that occurred at the beginning of the Sefer find their diametrically opposed sort of counterparts at the end. We see in Parak Chaf Pasuk Tet Zayin, Mikol Ha'am Hazeh, Shvameyot Ish Bachor Iter Yad Yimino, Kolzei Kolea Be'Even El Hasara V'Lo Yachati. We see Shevet Ben Yamin preparing for civil war. They know they're about to be attacked, and so they bring in their best fighters. And what is some of their best fighters are the lefties that will be able to, right, outmaneuver their own brothers and kill their own people. Okay, and so we see from beginning to end, and again, I am giving you two examples of a myriad of examples. It's almost impossible to read through Sefer Shoftim without seeing a motif that you saw in the beginning that you almost wrote off as inconsequential, see it reappear at the end of the Sefer and realize, oh my goodness, we've gotten to such a horrific point, and you sort of are almost forced to go back and question, how did that happen? Okay, and of course, what the Navi wants you to conclude is, it happens because there was no one overseeing how people behave, because Isha Yashar Be'inav Yaseh. Okay. That being said, okay, I think that one of the most prominent, I would say powerful ways in which the Navi convinces us that there needs to be a Melech Yisrael is through the stories of women. Okay? Again, I'm going to point you to your chart. Okay? If you look at the stories of women, and we're going to speak about some of them now, if you look at the stories of women, what you're going to notice is that the brave, heroic women appear at the beginning as counterparts to the righteous, God-fearing leaders, okay? And the stories in which women are victimized appear as society gets worse and worse and worse. And it's really, they parallel each other actually perfectly. We're going to start, if Otniel was the prototype for all future Shoftim, we're going to start with Achsa. Achsa was Otniel's wife. Okay? She was the daughter of Kalev, Kalev ben Yefuneh, from the generation of the Midbar, okay, the Tzadik, one of the Meraglim that didn't buy into the Lashon Hara that was spoken about the land. And Kalev, if you look at source number 10, Vayomer Kalev, Asher Yaket, Kiryat Sefer Luchadah, Minatati Moed Achsa Biti Lisha. Kalev, once again, a man is in battle. And he says, anyone who's able to be victorious in this war, I will give them my daughter. Now, I think that we just, for today, have to take our romantic notions of love and all those other things that we like to think of when we think of marriage aside. And remember that really in the ancient world, when a marriage was very much a contractual agreement, it didn't necessarily have as much to do with love as with other things in terms of alliances between people, between clans. It was really, on some level, I think they were very strategically and calculated in terms of marriage, who married whom. That being said, Kalev, the father of Achsa, makes a vow. Otniel wins in a battle, and he comes home and he gives Achsa to Otniel. Okay, and if you think about it, it was really a very protective measure. Here was this father ensuring that his daughter was married off to someone who could secure her safety. Okay, and we look, but what happened? Pasuk Yud Dalit. So she marries Otniel, the hero. She goes home, and then she decides this isn't enough. And so she gets on a donkey, she rides to her father's house, and he says, "Hi, what are you doing here?" Pasuk Tedva, Vatomer Lo. And so she says to him, "Hava li bracha, ki eretz hanegev nitzatati venatata li gulot mayim, vayitein lakalev et gulot ilit et gulot tachti." She said, "You basically pawned me off for this piece of land in the Negev. I also want some springs of water to go with it." And he said, "Okay." And that's basically how the story ends. Okay? I think that if we think, and by the way, I think I mentioned Kalev as being one of the Meraglim. Kalev wasn't a slouch. I don't think we could explain this story as, oh, he's an exception because she must have just sort of bullied him into it. I don't think Kalev was someone who was easily bullied based on his record. What we see here is an independent woman, a woman who uses the imperatives when she's speaking to the male authorities in her family, a woman who's not scared to leave her husband's home and travel on the public roads, and I'm mentioning that for reason, to her father's home, and who ostensibly returns home safely because we don't hear of her again. Okay? For that reason, I think, again, she is on some level the model of what happens in a normal society where people are normal, and I'm going to use that word sort of over and over. All right, if we turn to Perek Dalet, I'm going to mention the story of Yael and Zipporah. Okay, really not to get this, unfortunately. We're going to see the story, if I had to summarize the story of Yael and Zipporah, and again, keep an eye on your charts. Yael and Zipporah are still at the very beginning of the Sefer. They appear in Perek Dalet, okay, and Zipporah's song appears in Perek Hey. Okay, we haven't even met Gidon or Abimelech yet, and so things are still relatively calm, relatively good. If I had to summarize the story of Yael and about, or Yael and Zipporah, really, in about one or two sentences, I would say that their entire story overthrows the stereotypes that both we as readers and perhaps the people, or more precisely, the people of their day had about women. Okay, how do we see that? If we start with the very beginning, one of the first things we notice, and I apologize that we don't have time to read it here inside, one of the first things we notice is that Melech Yavin Melech Canaan, okay, and by the way, this is the last of the Canaanite kings that ever had the opportunity to attack Israel. Once Yael kills Sisera, that's the last we hear of Shivam Canaan. Beyond that, we deal with the Plishtim and the Midianim, but officially the task of conquering the Shivam Canaan was completed in this parak. One of the things that really I think is most fascinating in terms of Dvorah, if you read those first sukkim in terms of how she's described, many of the other females in Tanakh that end up as heroines were really, for the most part, living sort of relegated to the domestic life. And I think on some level, the public realm intruded in that life. If you think, for example, of the midwives, okay, they weren't out looking for trouble, they were doing their job, and the king of Mitzrayim came and told them they have to get involved politically in what was going on. If you look at Rahab, who was home when the Meraglim came and she harbored them and she provided safety. If you look really throughout Malachim, many of the women that get involved with the kings, that get involved with the various Nevi'im, they were often on the countryside staying in their homes when the public realm all sort of intruded into that part of their lives. Okay? Dvorah from the outset is in the public realm. The story begins with Dvorah sitting under a tree, okay, and judging the people. And I think, by the way, two very interesting points about her role also. The two roles of Shofet and Navi were two roles that were often questioned by the people. Okay, you think about the life of Yirmiyahu and Navi, think about Amos, most of their lives, they were trying to convince people that they were actually authentic Nevi'im, that people should accept them for what they were. Okay, same goes with the Shofet. The Shofet was someone who was, for the most part, often nominated by God, but it was up to the people to really accept, if that's a correct word, that nomination. Okay, Dvorah appears as, and no one is really contending those two roles. Okay, and I think on some level, the image of her sitting under the tree, she's, by the way, the only other Navi in all of Tanakh that we encounter other than Moshe Rabbeinu, who sat in one specific location and had people come to her to sort of decide what was going on or to respond to their questions. And so automatically, she appears as a total exception to every rule that we might have assumed. If you look a little bit further on, by the way, and again, this is all going to be about sort of reversing our expectations. If you look in Pasuk Chet, okay, she tells Barak, who was the general at the time, who was the one who was supposed to go out to war and fight the people. Dvorah says to him, go out, God is going to be on your side, and you have to go kill Sisera. Sisera was the general in Yavin's army. Barak says, okay, I'll only go if you come. A little bit, he was hesitant to go. He says, if you come with me, I will come. Okay, and what appears almost as a jab, she says, Pasuk Tet, Batomer, Haloch eleich imach, efes kilu tiyat tifartecha al haderach asher atah aleich, Hashem et Sisera. Okay? She says, okay, I'll go, but you're not going to be the one that gets the glory. A woman is going to win this war. Okay? Now, if we had never read this story before, and I think this in and of itself is an important point, and we never read this story, we're reading about an exceptional woman telling a man that an exceptional feat is going to take place in the hands of a woman. I think if we never heard of Yael, we might automatically assume that woman is going to be Dvorah. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I think that in and of itself is telling that the Navi is speaking of an exceptional woman, right? Referring to an exceptional woman, when you keep having exceptional, is that still the exception, or is that on some level the norm? Okay? And I think this entire generation we're going to be seeing, again, this underlying reversal of expectation. If you skip down a little bit, And again, I think this undoing of stereotypes is most important when we encounter Sisera. Okay? Pasuk Yud Zayin. Sisera, who was really a very formidable enemy because he had the iron chariot. The Israelites at that point didn't yet have the secrets of iron warfare. That was something the Plishtim kept very close and only sold to certain people. And Israel didn't yet have the chariot, didn't yet have the iron chariots. Okay, this was sort of the late bronze, early iron. And so really, Sisera was a very scary, formidable enemy. Pasuk Yud Zayin, but God made, as we find out in the song, he made this basically tidal wave, wiped out Sisera's fleet. Pasuk Yud Zayin, but Sisera not Firaglav. He runs away. He's escaping for his life. El Ohel Ya'el Eshet Chever Hakeni. Why does he run to Ya'el? Something we often forget to ask. Why he's running right in the countryside? Ki Shalom Bein Yavin Melech Hatzor Ubein Beit Chever Hakeni. Okay, because there was some sort of peace agreement that was established between her husband, Ya'el was Eshet Chever Hakeni, and Yavin Melech Hatzor. Okay, Sisera is running there because he assumes that if Chever Hakeni made a peace treaty with him, automatically his wife will be obligated and will respect that peace treaty. Okay? If you look a little bit later, another thing that sort of moors him into this false sense of security is when he gets there, Pasuk Yeched Vateitze Ya'el Ichrat Sisera, she invites him in and she really acts in a very, if you want to call it, typically maternal way. She asks for water, she gives him milk. He says, let me lie down. She covers him with a soft blanket. Okay, and so because Sisera is entering her tent, assuming that women have to sort of have to respect the peace treaties that their husbands are involved in, and assume that a woman is not dangerous, cannot do anything to him because she's behaving like a woman, he's lured into that false sense of security. And of course, as we know, it was really a deadly move because Ya'el takes the tent peg, ultimately kills him, and she was the woman who really got the honors, got the glory. Okay. If we look a little bit further down, Perek Hay, I'm just going to mention something about the Song of Dora is actually really, really very fascinating. I think that we know from Tanakh in general, songs have a very powerful way of influencing, really, the psyche of the people. There's a reason that Shirat Hayam, following Kriyat Yam Suf, was such a pivotal point in Yetziat Mitzrayim. There's something very effective about the songs that people sing after wars or after victories. Perhaps even more interesting than that, there's been a suggestion that the Song of Dvorah, and this is a little bit sort of beyond the scope of this shiur, but I'll just mention it, that the Song of Dvorah was not only a victory song to be honored within her country, but that it was a riposte, which is basically an ancient form of song in which the victorious side would, this is going to sound a tiny bit complicated, would sort of accept the insults and the stereotypes that the enemy had been hurling at them sort of leading up to the war, right? You want to call it trash talk, whatever you want to call it. The enemy had been trash talking them, and so when that side is victorious, they hurl those insults right back at them, okay? And without going into too much detail, but it's a really a very fascinating concept, if we think in those terms, then really Dvorah's song didn't only hold sway within her country, but it really, on some level, okay, had international renown, because there's no doubt that if this is the song that was being sung amongst her own people, the Canaanites were hearing it, okay, and responding in kind. And so we see that her song is very effective. But I want to focus on one specific aspect of her song, which is Perek. In the end of Perek, she speaks about the mother of Sisera. Okay, and once again, I think we're going to be dealing with our expectations of women, and those expectations being overturned. We see Pasuk Chachet in Perek Hay, Min Source 11. Says the Ad Haharonish Kefava Tiabeiv Eim Sisera Be'ad Ha'eshnav Madua Bo Sheish Rikbo Lavo. And by the way, in the ancient Near East, this was a very prominent image of women as standing behind the lattice, standing behind a window, peering outward. It was very, very. You see it a lot of times in the art and stuff that they excavate, both from inside Eretz Yisrael in Egypt as well. She's standing behind the window and she's lamenting and she's crying, why is my son delayed? Okay, and I think at first, many of us, if not all of us, on some level, almost feel sympathetic. We almost want to feel bad for her. We almost want this understanding of what it is for a woman waiting for a child to return home from war to cross those ethnic boundaries. Okay? But as we get a little bit further, if we read, what is she fantasizing about? Pasuk Lamed. What is she fantasizing about? Her son returning with all of his men from war, with all the fine, wool and the different, and the different embroideries, and the women that they're going to bring home. Hopefully, one or two women for each man. And they refer to them as racham rachamatayim. Okay, almost wombs, as if these women are nothing more than potential mothers of potential slaves. Okay, and I think, again, we read this story and we on some level are questioning, what are the expectations of women? Here is this woman, if you think about what Sisera's mother is really singing about, I think it was the reality of wartime. Okay, that for the most part in wartime, the fate of women was determined by what happened in the battlefield. If the men were successful, then the women home in the tents were safe. If the men failed, then the women were subject, and they were sort of victim, to anything that happens to prisoners of war. Okay? That's what Sisera's mother is thinking about. What Yael really shows, if you think about it, is that that's not necessarily the case. That a woman in her own tent, okay, can not only maintain safety, but she can ensure that her entire family, that inside her tent, and her entire family remains safe. Okay? By not, if you want to call it sort of, confirming to the really traditional stereotypes of what happens to a woman in war. Okay, when we read Sisera's story, Sisera's mother, we're disturbed, okay, but we can almost write it off as, and this is sort of going to bring us back to the beginning, we can write off her impression of women as nothing but just wombs to bring home and have future slaves, okay, as that's really distinctly Canaanite. We would never behave like this. Our people don't treat women like this, okay, but in fact, we saw, okay, in the beginning, something similar, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to summarize three chapters in about 3 seconds. You have? Okay, working against the clock. After the story of Pelegesh Begiva, this brings us back to the original topic. After the story of Pelegesh Begiva, if you recall, the man wanted to, he said this act should be denounced. Now, he never makes it clear, should the rape of the woman, which he caused himself, be denounced, or should the dismemberment be denounced? It's not really clear. Clearly the guy was a shady fellow to begin with. You have him sending out the pieces of her body, and the tribes all react, and they say, this is terrible, we must go kill the people of Giva. And so they go up to Binyamin, and they say, send out the people of Giva, we have to kill them. Okay? And the people, and Sheva Binyamin says, we're not going to send them out. And that, when I mentioned the civil war breaks out, all of the nations go up, kill all of the people in Sheva Binyamin. Okay? Except 600 men from Sheva Binyamin got away. Okay, they ran away and they survived. A little while later, the rest of the Shvatim say, what are we going to do? This Shevet Binyamin is going to be wiped off the map if we don't find them wives. Okay, now the Navi doesn't have to say it, but what we should automatically be realizing is that there's no wives for them to marry. Okay, that means that the rest of the Shvatim murdered all of the women from Shevet Binyamin. Okay, but that's almost taken as a given. So you have 600 left over from Shevet Binyamin who have no one to marry. And one of the reasons, important point, the reason they have no one to marry is because in the heat of the civil war, when everyone was angry and the emotions were flying, the rest of the nation says, we will never allow our daughters to marry anyone from Sheva Binyamin. Okay. The emotions calm down a little bit, the war is over, and they realize there are these 600 men left, no one for them to marry because of this vow made in the heat of the moment. And so what do? They say, oh, hold on a second, the elderly righteous men of the nation get involved in figuring out how to get us out of this vow that we made during war. Okay, something which perhaps would have been helpful for the daughter of Yiftah. So they all come together and they decide and they say, you know what we're going to do? There's this little area of Yavesh Gilad that didn't come out and help us fight the war. Let's go kill them and take their virgin daughters. And that's exactly what they do. But there was a mathematical error because there were only 400 virgin daughters and there were 600 Benjamite men. So what do? Once again, they're just trying to figure out, what are we going to do? How are we going to figure it out? And so there was a festival at Shiloh, where Benot Shiloh, the daughters of Shiloh, would come out. The text doesn't make it 100% clear, but they were dancing in the vicinity of vineyards. And so it was probably some sort of agricultural festival that they had on a yearly basis. And what they had is those leftover 200 Benjamite men hiding behind the trees. Okay, and the word orev, meaning ambush, that's used in wartime, is used. And when they saw that Benot Shiloh come out, they would pounce, they would kidnap them, and take them back. Why was this brilliant? Because the old men explained, if the fathers and brothers of these women say, oh, but they can't marry you, we have a response. You're not giving them to the Binyamins. The Binyamins are taking them. Problem solved. And that is how the story of Shoftim, the entire book, ends. Okay. In a nutshell. Well, I think that if we go back, I think that there's a couple of, we spoke about markers, we spoke about themes really being traced through the entire story of Shoktim. I think that one of the things that we notice from the beginning is that, especially if we use Achsa as a marker, okay, we see that women are able to be independent. We see not only are women able to be independent, but Kalev never reacts. Kalev never says to her, wait a second, you're not allowed to ask for land. You shouldn't really be commanding me anything. There's this almost given assumption that women can speak to men on some level as equals. We see Dvorah commanding Barak to go out to war. Okay? There's almost this way, a mode of behaving that's not necessarily seen as anything out of the ordinary. And I think that what happens is that we see certain themes really reflecting this degenerative process. If you think about the vow that was made at the very beginning of the Sefer, for example, we have a vow made by a father, okay, for the sake really of, and again, we have to keep our romantic notions of marriage aside, for the sake of protecting his daughter. Okay, all of the parties were clearly defined, and it really followed a predetermined set of behavior. Right? He said, I will marry her to this X man, and he does so. A little further in the Sefer, we have the daughter of Yiftach. Okay? And a vow is made during battle, and this daughter of Yiftach can't get out of that vow. And by the way, perhaps even more disturbing, it should be really more disturbing, if any of us remember the story of Shaul, who also makes a vow in wartime and says, any of the men who eat during the war are going to be killed. His own son, Yonatan, dips his finger in the honey, or dips the end of the stick, licks the honey, and Shaul says, well, we're going to have to kill you. And all of the men rally around him and say, no, 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 don't kill him. And in fact, Shaul doesn't kill him. Okay, and so with those stories in the back of our minds, it's even more disturbing. And again, what we see is vows taken during wartime can be a positive protective measure. As the books go on, and clearly the very end of the Sefer will be final vow taken against the Binyamin, causes the murder of hundreds of thousands of people. Okay? Another thing we notice is that the names, okay? If we look at the women, in the beginning of the Sefer, they're all named. We have Achsa, we have Yael, we have Devorah, okay? They all receive names. They're independent human beings. As the story goes on, as the book goes on, not only are they no longer named, but their identity is completely wrapped up in the male with which their relation, with which they have a relationship. And so you have the daughter of Yiftach, you have the Pilegesh, you have the daughters of Shiloh. Okay? And tragically, it's exactly those men that are supposed to be protecting them, okay, that ultimately cause them the most harm. Okay? And again, it's all following this degenerative process. Another thing, and again, the relationships between the men and the women is indicative through their behavior. And if we had more time, again, we could sort of go through this all inside, the way that the women speak to the men in their families, the men with which they have a relationship. If you look at the end of the Sefer, okay, something we may not even notice is that the women at the end of the book don't even speak. Okay, not a word is uttered in the story of Pilegesh Vegivah by the Pilegesh herself. Okay, not a word of refusal or of, we don't hear even a word from the women who are kidnapped on the fields in Shiloh. Okay? And again, with the counterpart Devorah, when we realize the extent to which women's voices can resonate, the silence at the end of the Sefer, the silence of the women reverberates, I think, that much more powerfully. Okay? We have another thing which I think is also extraordinarily important is the notion of space. Okay? We have public space and we have private space. And I think traditionally the understanding was that private space was safer within the home was safe. Okay? And we see at the very beginning of the Sefer is again the story of Shoktim in an ideal world overturning those stereotypes. Achsa safely traveled from her husband's home to her father's home. Yael safely left her tent and created a safe haven within her tent. Devorah functions in the public realm. Okay? As the story goes on, Bat Yiftach running out of her house, leaving the home, becomes a very dangerous endeavor. Okay? Beyond that, if we think back to the Pilegesh, even remaining in the home is no longer safe because she was within the home and her husband shoved her out. Okay? And so the private, the personal space versus the public space even changes drastically as the story goes on. So just to conclude, I think that... And again, I really do apologize. We started late and we rushed. Anyone has questions after, please feel free. But I think if we go back to the beginning of, the beginning of the talk, I think that if we understand what the polemical nature of the work of Shoktim is, okay, then to argue that Tanakh sees women as expendable or sees them as worthless, utilizing them as a gauge for lawful or lawless behavior of society would be futile. Okay? The only reason using women as a marker and as almost a yardstick for the morality or immorality of society is because Tanakh has an exemplary, I think, view of them and an inherent understanding of the potential and the ideals that could be reached in a quote-unquote normal society. Okay? That being said, again, I think the silence of the text is not an indicator that the author of Schulzmann is vindicating the behavior of the people. If anything, I think it's a very, very powerful literary device in which he almost reflects or mirrors the silence of the women at the end of the book. We as readers should be shocked. We as readers should be outraged at the silence at the end of the Sefer. And what should strike us is that the silence is by the people around them. No one is speaking up. No one is defending these women. And through that comes to the conclusion, again, that in a society without a king, Ein Melech Yisrael, Isha Yashar Ve'Einav Ta'aseh, the entire really society just unraveled at the seams. And so again, I'll finish, I know everyone's running to the next year. I think that if we can extend this model to all the other stories that we incorporate in Tanakh and sort of keep the eternal messages, really the messages that transcend history, keep that separate from the historical setting, I think we'll really be able to better appreciate the messages of this story. Well done.